much, Michael, for this very kind presentation. Thanks to everybody for coming here. And well, yes, in fact, this is the first time that I try to present my certain aspects of my work on the Zhantun Qi in public, except for the book. And I'd like just to show that this work entitled the Zhantun Qi, well, first of all, is beautiful, fascinating, interesting, but unfortunately very difficult text, at least for me. And second, that there are two possible ways of reading this text, and I will especially focus on the second of these two ways. So, to begin, while I show you some of the more interesting additions of the text, let me start with a few remarks about the text itself. The full title of this work is Zhouyi Zhantun Qi, which I translate as the Seal of the Unity of the Three in accordance with the Book of Changes. The picture you see here is one of the two earliest texts and commentaries, dating from about 700. This is found in the Taoist canon. The Zhantun Qi is usually divided into three books, Pian, or sometimes like here, Jian, chapter. Book one and two contain the main text. These portions of the Zhantun Qi are written in four or five character verses with a few passages in prose. The picture here shows one of the best known commentaries by Peng Xiao, dating from the mid 10th century. The third of the three books contains later materials. This book is also written in poetry, but in prosodic forms different from those used in books one and two. This is a commentary by a very well-known author, Zhu Xi, dating from the very end of the 12th century. The question of authorship and dating is quite complex in this case, so let me just say that the Zhantun Qi is traditionally attributed to Wei Boyang, who is said to be an alchemist who lived in the 2nd century and wrote, according to tradition, his work around the year 150. So, as I said, the problems in dating the Zhantun Qi are truly remarkable, and I will say something about this subject only at the end of my talk. A preface found in one of the commentaries to the Zhantun Qi begins by saying, the Zhantun Qi is the forefather of the scriptures on the elixir of all times. Its words are ancient and profound, arcane and subtle. No one can fathom their meaning. These words express several significant features of the Zhantun Qi: the charm of its verses, the depth of its discourse, its enigmatic language, and its intimate relation to the Taoist alchemical traditions. Under its poetical language and thick layers of images and symbols, the Zhantun Qi hides the exposition of a doctrine that has inspired a large number of commentaries and other works, and has attracted the attention not only of Taoist masters and adepts, but also of philosophers, cosmologists, poets, literati, calligraphers, philologists, and bibliophiles. This is a manuscript of the Zhantun Qi. It's a work by a famous calligrapher, Zhao Wenfu. This particular manuscript is interesting not only as a work of art, but also because it is the earliest original record of the Zhantun Qi that we have from 1310. So, I mean, earlier works are available now in later editions compared to 1310. Um, I have made a catalogue of 38 extant commentaries to the Santunci, written between the 8th and the 19th century. These commentaries are extant in about, at least actually, 150 editions. More than 60 lost works contain the words Santunci in their titles, and dozens of texts found in the Taoist canon and elsewhere are related to it. There are poems by Li Po and by Yu Ji about this text. There is another work entitled Santunci, written by Shi Tou Xiqian, who is the reputed forefather of Soto Zen, who wrote a Buddhist text entitled Santunci. Except for the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi, few other works have enjoyed a similarly vast and diversified exegetical tradition. This is the commentary by Chen Zhixu. It's apparently a unique exemplar now kept in the Shanghai Library, and this is the edition on which I've based my translation. So there are many important issues and questions concerning the Santunci, but one of the most important is the fact that within the Taoist tradition there have been two main ways of reading this work. One is the alchemical reading, and the second, I call it doctrinal reading, provisionally. What I mean by these terms is that in the first case, the Santunci is read in relation to alchemical practices, while in the second reading, it is read in a more comprehensive way with regard to its doctrines, and not only which are not only alchemical. So, to discuss this point, first let me briefly remind that alchemy has existed in China in two main branches. The first one, Wai Dan, or external alchemy, is based on the refining of minerals and metals in order to extract the original essences of the ingredients and make elixirs with those essences. The second branch is Nei Dan, or internal alchemy. Here, the ingredients of the elixir are the prime, original components of the cosmos and the human being. The whole process takes place within the practitioner. External alchemy is documented from the second century BC and declined from approximately the 16th century. Internal alchemy is documented from the 8th century AD and is still practiced nowadays. So between these two traditions, Nei Dan is the one that has shaped the dominant image of the and understanding of the Santunci in China by offering explanations that have one point in common. The Santunci contains a complete illustration of the principles and methods of internal alchemy. It is, in particular, the first earliest Nei Dan text. Basically, according to this reading, every all verses of the Santunci are read as related to alchemy, including, for example, those found in portions concerned with cosmology, with actual or symbolic astronomic phenomena. We will see an example. With true man, with the sage ruler, who are seen, both of them, as metaphors of the alchemist. This reading has been the most widespread and has led to the view that the Santunci has a single author, Wei Boyan, a single date, the Han Dynasty, and a single subject, alchemy. There is, in addition to this one, there has been within the Taoist tradition a second, less well-known way of reading the text. This reading takes account of a point that is reflected in the title of the Santunci, the unity of the three. Is stated more than once in its verses and is often described by commentators. The Santunci is concerned not with one, but with three major subjects and joins them to one another into a single doctrine, of which alchemy is one aspect. These subjects are integrated with one another into a unique presentation of a doctrine that includes a metaphysics, a cosmology, a description of the highest realized state, and a canonical form of practice. Well, there's an important point, I believe, here, that the first reading, the alchemical reading, reflects a traditional truth that can hardly be disputed and is in all respects inalienable and virtually impervious to historical analysis. What I mean by this is that I believe that virtually no adept of the alchemical practices would accept the view that the Tantan Qi is not entirely concerned with alchemy, has more than one author, was written at different times, and so forth. It's a traditional truth and can hardly be discussed. The second perspective, instead, allows a broader scope to inquiries into the origin of the three subjects and, as we will see, the respective textual components. My point is not something like deconstructing the view that the Tantan Qi is a Neidan text. That's not my interest. I think that the Neidan reading of the Tantan Qi is perfectly valid, legitimate, and has been historically very important. I would just like to show that there is, in addition, another doctrinal view of the Tantan Qi within Taoism. This has already been mentioned. A confirmation of the fact that the second reading has a textual foundation comes from the fact that if this reading is taken into account, it is not difficult to identify within the sequence of poems in the first two books several contiguous portions that are devoted to each of the three main subjects. It has been quite difficult to identify these particular subjects and sequences in the text if it is read as a Neidan work. So, let's start from cosmology. I'd like to show in some detail something about the first of the three main subjects of the Tantan Qi. The main purpose of the cosmological portions of this text is to define the relationship of the cosmos to the Tao. This relation is described by means of emblems that represent the modes taken on by the Tao in its self-manifestation and the corresponding features of being. On the basis of this definition, a set of principles is derived that serve to establish the cosmological science of alchemy, which is described in other parts of the Tantan Qi. Although the names Qian, Kun, Kan, and Li belong to the vocabulary of the Book of Changes, it would be impossible to understand the functions that they play in a work like the Tantan Qi, as long as they are seen as no more than trigrams or hexagrams. From the perspective of the Tantan Qi, Qian, Kun, Kan, and Li are formless principles that serve to explicate how the Tao generates the relative domain and manifests itself in it. The corresponding trigrams and hexagrams are symbolic forms, Qian, used to represent those principles. Qian and Kun are the two primary modes taken on by the Tao in generating the world. This is stated, for example, in two very well-known passages of the Book of Changes. Great indeed is Qian, the origin, the 10,000 things owe their beginning to him. Perfect indeed is Kun, the origin, the 10,000 things owe their birth to her. It is, for me, it's almost impossible to avoid using the pronouns he and she with regard to Qian and Kun instead of it. But anyway, these passages define the two main functions of Qian and Kun. Qian let's say, gives the initial input, and Kuhn brings creation to achievement. Qian is the active, creative principle, essence, yang, and heaven. Kuhn is the passive or receptive principle, substance, yin, and earth. Although I think that the two best metaphors to understand the functions of Qian and Kuhn are those of seed and land. The seed wastes its creative power without the land, and the land is fruitless without the seed. Being permanently joined to one another in the pre-cosmic domain, Qian entrusts its creative power to Kuhn, and Kuhn brings creation to accomplishment. Through their continuous play, their continuous conjunction, and their continuous exchange, Qian and Kuhn generate the world. In the everlasting instance in which Qian and Kuhn give birth to the cosmos, the yang of Qian moves on to Kuhn, and in response, the yin of Kuhn moves into Qian. In the symbolic representation by the corresponding trigrams, Qian entrusts its essence, the central solid line, to Kuhn and becomes Li, and Kuhn receives that essence from Qian and becomes Kan. So Kan and Li therefore replace Qian and Kuhn in the cosmic domain. Since they harbor the yang of Qian and the yin of Kuhn as their own inner essences, Kan and Li enable the yin and yang of the pre-cosmic domain to operate in the cosmic domain. Kan and Li, in other words, carry the essences of Qian and Kuhn through the divisions of space and the segments of time. It's a very brief outline of the main principles. Now, the question is who, according to the Santun Shi, uses these emblems and this representation of the cosmic process, and what is the purpose of these emblems? Two verses of the Santun Shi state that original essence is subtle and can hardly be beheld, infer its rules, and attest its tokens. The tokens are the images that represent the operation of the original essence in the cosmos. So, what are these images? The main images of Qian and Kuhn are heaven and earth, which are immutably joined to one another. And the main images of Kan and Li are the moon and the sun, which alternate in their growth and decline during the different time cycles. This alternation, day and night, the seasons, and so forth, is the main visible sign of the operation of Qian and Kuhn in the cosmos. The emblems of the Book of Changes make it possible to represent this operation. The Santun Shi describes three main emblematic cosmological cycles: the day, the month, and the year. All of them are determined and actually consist of the cyclical ascent and descent of yin and yang through time, and are represented by means of trigrams and hexagrams of the Book of Changes, and of course by several other sets of emblems about which I will say nothing here. I will just focus on the emblems of the Book of Changes. And I will only talk about one of the three cycles, which is formed by the 30 days of the lunar month. The month is divided into six parts of 5 days, and each of the six parts is associated with a trigram and with one of the 10 celestial stamps. The six trigrams illustrate, as we will see, the rise and fall of yin, the broken line, and yang, the solid line, during the 30 days of the month. Each of the six stages are matched with the corresponding stamps to nodal days in the waxing and waning of the moon. So this is the first node, the second node, third one, fourth one, fifth, and finally the sixth. So the six trigrams, we can show again here, represent the growth and decline of the young principle from its birth at the beginning of the month until its complete obscuration at the end of the month. Now, while this is configuration of emblems essentially describes astronomic phenomena, the most important significant aspect of this device is the symbolic event that happens between the end of a lunar cycle and the beginning of the next. In your handout, you should have two poems about this subject. There are two passages of the Zantan Chi that talk of the meeting of sun and moon in the last night of the month. This is the first one. In the inchoate boundless, female and male follow one another. Their nurturing fluids moisten and impregnate. Their emanations and transformations flow and spread all through. This happens when, between the month's last day and next month's first day, the sun and the moon join their tallies and move to the center. Second passage is similar. There is one part in prose and then continues in poetry. The masculine yang spreads his mysterious emanation. The feminine yin transforms her yellow wrap, her womb. In indistinction, they conjoin. At this incipient time, the root is planted. So when these passages state that in the night of our Novilune, the 30th day, the sun and the moon move to the center of space. When they conjoin, they regenerate the light of the young principle after the darkness of the month's last night. The characters for sun and moon placed next to one another form the character for light. When they conjoin, the sun and the moon also give birth to the next cycle of change. And here, the characters for sun and moon, again, placed not next to one another, but one on top of the other, form the character for change. This etymology, which is mentioned in the Zantan Chi, has nothing to do with philology, but pertains to the analogic function of forms which embody and represent formless principles. These forms include even the characters of the written language. So to go back to our example, at the end of the month, Kun stands for the complete obscuration of the Yang principle and now dominates over the entire cosmos. However, Kun receives the essence of Qian when sun and moon join, and being the mother, she gives birth to her first son, Zhen. The initial trigram in the new lunar cycle, whose lower yang line, the solid line at the bottom, represents the rebirth of light. So after an instant of suspension, time again begins to flow and the next month begins. Now, who is the first, at least symbolically, the first recipient of these parts of the text? These parts of the Zantan Chi give prominence to the role and functions of the ruler. The king, who is placed at the symbolic center of the human realm, his kingdom, and specifically his court, should guarantee the reciprocal agreement of heaven, earth, and mankind. Trigrams and hexagrams of the Book of Changes and other related emblems enable him to comprehend the patterns of heaven and earth, and to model his governance on those patterns. These portions of the text can be read as literally as advice given to the ruler, or metaphorically as instructions addressed to the alchemist in the alchemical reading. In any case, in a work like the Zantan Chi, the ruler, in relation to his kingdom, is first of all a subordinate counterpart of the sage in relation to the whole of being, in accordance to principles first expressed in the Tao Te Ching. There are two more poems about this, and this is really very interesting for its terminology. It says that, similar to an artisan and a charioteer, the sage ruler resides at the center of his domain and conforms his conduct to the patterns of space and time. The images and emblems used to explicate the functioning of the cosmos, the system of pitch pipes and the calendar, enable him to respond to change while maintaining himself in a state of non-action, not doing work. This is a very interesting passage, especially because it refers to the four emblematic tools that traditionally symbolize the ruler's government, the compass, the square, the marking pole, and the plumb line. There's another passage here. Which should be in your handout. So, by essentially, the purpose of these representations, from the point of view of the ruler, is that the patterns of yin and yang pervade and unify the domains of heaven, earth, and humanity, and the ruler's task is to guarantee and maintain the agreement among these domains. So this requires that the ruler operates according to those patterns. And if he does so, says this passage, the influence of his words extends throughout and even beyond his kingdom, bringing about different effects according to the circumstances. The ruler, in this way, embodies and makes manifest the creative action of heaven within the human world. What Kun is for Qian, what earth is for heaven, and what the world is for the saint, this is the kingdom for the saint, the sage ruler. Now, there's the second main subject of the text. After having defined the principles of metaphysics and cosmology, the Santunqi describes the two ways of realization that it upholds. First, the Taoist way of non-doing, and second, the way of alchemy. Now, about Taoism, I will try to say as little as possible. The Santunqi refers to Taoism as Huan Lao, an expression formed by the names of Huan Di, the Yellow Emperor, with Taoism is the exemplary ruler who applies the Taoist teaching mainly, but not only, to the art of government and laws. However, by Huan Lao, the Tangu Qi means the foundational principles expounded in the Tao Te Ching and the Guangzi, both of which are repeatedly quoted in the Taoist sections of the Tangu Qi. The most important of these principles for the Santunqi is non-doing, which defines the operation of the Taoist saint in the world. The most important principles at the basis of these portions of the Santunqi are stated in a very short poem that says, superior virtue has no doing, it does not use examining and seeking. Inferior virtue does, its operation does not rest. This poem is directly based, in turn, on a well-known passage of the Tao Te Ching. Superior virtue has no doing, there is nothing whereby it does. Inferior virtue does, there is something whereby it does. In both the Tao Te Ching and the Santunqi, the subject of these verses is the distinction between non-doing and doing, Wu Wei, Yo Wei, respectively referred to as the ways of superior virtue, Shande, and inferior virtue, or Xiade. The scope of these two ways is hard to describe in a few words, but one could say that in the way of superior virtue, the state prior to the separation of the one into the two, and so forth until the 10,000 things, is spontaneously attained. The distinction between the one between 1 and 2 does not even arise, and the unity of the pre-celestial and the post-celestial domains is immediately realized. There is no need to seek the one breath of the Tao, the I Chi of the Tao, and therefore no support, no whereby E, as the passage we've seen says, no support is necessary to find it. This is the way of the true man, the Taoist, the Zhen Ren, the realized being. Inferior virtue, instead, focuses on seeking. Its continuous search of the one breath needs support. And the post-celestial domain is used, again, E, to find the pre-celestial state that is hidden within the post-celestial. The way of inferior virtue is the way of alchemy. Performing a practice, whether it is internal or external, is a form of doing. The alchemical process is conducted in order to, again, E, attain the realized state. Its purpose is to prepare one to enter the state of non-doing, and alchemy is fulfilled only when this happens. The realized being is called true man in the Zanten Chi, or Zhen Ren. There is no need to spend too many words in order to define his inner state. It's just enough to say that its descriptions in the Zanten Chi are based on passages of the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi, the two main texts that define the state of complete realization according to the principles and the discourse of Taoism. I will skip a few passages. Here's a few slides that are in the handouts, where essentially this is the main passage that describes the condition of the true man according to the Zanten Chi. And what is highlighted in red are corresponding terms between passages of the Zanten Chi above and the Tao Te Ching. So this is a passage that talks about shutting the openings, a term, an expression that comes straight from the Laozi, from the Tao Te Ching. They should all be in your, poem of the Zanten Chi is in the handouts. This is about sinking into the ground, which is an expression that comes from Zhuangzi. And finally, another reference to the Tao Te Ching with the sentence, very famous, watching, you do not see it, it is invisible, it is called invisible, and so forth. So, another interesting aspect of the Taoist portions of the Zanten Chi is that here we find also a criticism of practices that are deemed to be incorrect or inadequate for true realization. These practices are of two kinds. The first kind is non-alchemical practices, including breathing, meditation on the inner gods, sexual practices, and worship of spirits and minor deities. These are verses from the main section that deals with these practices, and here, passing through the viscera, or Li Zhang, is an early term that refers to visualizing in succession the gods inner observation or inner contemplation is the also refers to meditation on the inner gods. And then treading the deeper, replacing the asteries, it denotes the Taoist meditation methods of Wu Gang, facing the celestial net. the expressions here, 9 and 1, way of yin, and indicate sexual techniques. And finally, ingesting breath, of course, refers to breathing practices. Wording is similar to this about the performance of incorrect practices or the incorrect interpretation of certain notions and terms. Will continue in the later chemical traditions and become even more radical than these. Anyway, the second kind of criticism that we find in the Zantun Chi is addressed to alchemical practices that are not based on the principle of being of the same kind or category in that. This is one part of the poem that is contained in this subject, and it criticizes clearly several Weidan methods, several methods of external alchemy. It is enough to read this section with attention, however, to notice that the criticism is not addressed to Weidan per se, but to the Weidan methods that are not based on the conjunction of lead and mercury. Only lead and mercury, according to the Zantun Chi, are of the same kind, or Kunlei, the same category, as Tian and Kun. And for this reason, they can represent and enable the conjunction of Qian and Kun. So what is then the alchemical model that and the alchemical practices that the Zantun Chi promotes and describes? Even though, as we have seen, alchemy, according to the Zantun Chi, is the way of inferior virtue. The basic principles are simple and straightforward and proceed directly from the views of the Zantun Chi on the relation between the Tao and the 10,000 things, the world in which we live. As in the whole of Taoism, this relation is explained by means of a sequence of stages. The absolute principle establishes itself first as unity, often called in this function pure yang or chun yang. Unity divides itself into the active and the passive principles. These principles, still in their pure original state, are called true yang and true yin. As the active and the passive principles conjoin, they exchange their essences and give birth to all entities and phenomena of the world. So here there's a sort of imperceptible line where actual manifestation occurs. True yin and true yang are not manifested in their pure state in this world. Then true yin is now found within yang, and true yang is found within yin. The true yin is also called yin within yang, and true yang is called yin within yin. All these stages occur simultaneously. Now, exactly the same configuration can be described by means of qian, kun, kang, and lin. Unity here is the single solid line, which we also find again in Qian and Alexander Kun. Kan and Li are perfectly equivalent to the black and white halves of the yin-yang emblem. The black half contains a white dot, which is equal to the inner line of within Kan. And the white half contains a black dot, which is equal to the inner line within Li. And the same configuration can be also represented by means of the five agents and by means of metals and minerals. This is the typical chemical representations, representation according to the Zantun Chi. Here, true yin and true yang are represented by mercury and lead, respectively. So at this point, it is perfectly clear that the alchemical process consists in inverting the sequence of the generative process of the cosmos. From its own perspective, which is dominated by duality, the cosmos is a reflection of the absolute principle. And like all reflections, it is an inverted image of that principle. The world is yin in relation to the Tao, but conceals its own its one breath, which is through yang. Alchemy, therefore, consists in tracing the stages of the generative process of the cosmos in a reverse sequence in order to recover the hidden one breath and return to it. Essentially, what the alchemist looks for is the white dot within the black, the light. In alchemical imagery, this process consists in liberating through mercury and through lead from their temporary residences within black lead and cinnabar, and in joining them to one another. Beyond the alchemical metaphor, this does not only mean that all yin contains a part of yang and vice versa, which of course is true. There is something more important. The true nature of yin is hidden within yang, and the true nature of yang is hidden within yin. When yin and yang conjoin, each finds in the other not only its match or its mate, but also its own innermost nature. It is only through their joining that yin and yang can return to their original state. So this is a very broad outline of three main subjects, and there is no particular conclusion at this point. I think I just wanted to show what are these three subjects. Just I have some additional slides, but I'm not even sure that it's necessary to show them. The main point is simply that when these three subjects are taken into account, the fact that the Zanpin Chip contains originally three main subjects, when this is considered, it is possible to identify the respective textual components, and it becomes fairly clear that these parts of the text have been written by different authors at different times. So I have examples, but I wouldn't like to talk too much. Maybe this is very briefly. This is this concerns the alchemical parts of the Zanpin Chi. When you look at that, when you look at these parts of the text as alchemy, it becomes clear that the motive of alchemy in the Zanpin Chi is entirely different from the alchemical model of texts dating from the Han period, and actually even later texts. The alchemical model of the Zanpin Chi began to be used in alchemy from the 7th century. So it is practically impossible that something written in the 2nd century was ignored by the entire alchemical tradition for at least 5 centuries. In Huaidan, and even more in Neidan. We don't have Neidan text until the 8th century. So, there's an interesting question about the device to represent the moon cycle that we've seen above before. That device is actually attributed to Yufan, who is the last great cosmologist of the Han period. And in his commentary, there's a passage that is basically identical to the description given in Zanpin Chi. This is the Zanpin Chi passage. It just describes the moon cycle with the northern days, which stage and corresponding trigram, and Tiangang, the celestial branch. And these are the six stages. there's a fragment of Ufan's commentary that is basically the same. Now, Ufan lived at the very end of the Han period, actually until a little later, and scholars who have quoted this passage by Ufan have said that Ufan based his description of the Tantan Shi. I think that it is quite likely, to say the least, that the opposite is true, and the Tantan Shi has drawn its description from Ufan. And this means in turn that the composition of this part of the Tantan Shi should be postdated by at least one century. This is the final point. There are about 60 terms in the Tantan Shi that are shared with very important and well-known text on meditation on the inner gods. And this text dates, pertains to the Shanxing revelations of the second half of the 4th century. So it seems quite unlikely that the Tantan Shi, that the traditional dating of the Tantan Shi to the Han Dynasty is historically correct. And the fact that these shared terms are found in all sections, in all portions of the Tantan Shi, those on cosmology, on Taoism and alchemy, seems to mean that there's been a sort of, I called it, anonymous hand of the tradition of the southern Taoist tradition that revised at some stage the text and arranged it in the form in which we have it today. And this probably happened after the end of the 4th century and perhaps even later, if we keep in mind the fact that there's no source that uses the Tantan Shi until at least the 7th century. So I may conclude, therefore, by saying that the Tantan Shi was composed in different stages, maybe for the Han period onward, but did not reach a form substantially similar to the present one before about 450, and possibly even one or two centuries later. Concerning the Nedan view that the Tantan Shi is the first Nedan text, I would say rather that the Tantan Shi is the first text of Nedan. And more important than these issues, or even any attempt of dating, establishing a precise date, however, is the fact that in the light of what we have seen, Wei Guoyang, the traditional order, is much more than a semi-legendary alchemist in the mid-second century. He is rather the single